All right, I think we're ready to begin. I'm Chris Sharon. I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And this week I'm doing a series on faith and torture. This is the second session. Today we'll follow the same basic structure that we followed in our first session, which is to have an opening provocation and give us a chance to talk a little bit about that. And then do some background work that will help us go deeper into this question, and then end with an engagement in a spiritual practice. And today the question is about the relationship between the church and the state, how the church understands itself and its relationship to the state. And the title is not really meant to be playful, it's meant to be true. That if the church is the soul of the nation, the church gets stepped on. And we're going to see a couple of examples of that. I want to start, as I did last time, with a parable from my friend Pete Rollins' book, The Orthodox Heretic, which is simply a whole bunch of contemporary tales, he calls them. He's a little too shy to call them parables, but parables they are. This is chapter 17. There was once a small town filled with believers who always sought to act in obedience to the teachings of God. When faced with difficult situations, the leaders of the community would often be found deep in prayer or searching the scriptures for guidance and wisdom. Late one evening, in the middle of winter, a young man from the neighboring city arrived at the gates of the town's church seeking refuge. The caretaker, a man of deep faith, immediately let him in, and seeing that he was hungry and cold, provided a warm meal and some fresh clothes. After he had rested, the young man explained how he had fled the city because the authorities had labeled him a political dissident. It turned out the man had been critical of both the government and the church in his work as a journalist. The caretaker brought the young man back to his home and allowed him to stay until a plan had been worked out concerning what to do next. When the priest was informed of what had happened, he called the leaders of the town together in order to work through what ought to be done. After 2 days of discussion, it was agreed that the man should be handed over to the authorities in order to face up to the crimes he had committed. But the caretaker protested, saying, "This man has committed no crimes. He has merely criticized what he believes to be the injustices perpetrated by the authorities in the name of God." "What you say may be true," replied the priest, "but his presence puts the whole of this town in danger. For what if the authorities find out where he is and learn we have protected him?" But the caretaker refused to hand him over to the priest, saying, "He is my guest, and while he is under my roof, I will ensure that no harm comes to him. If you take him from me by force, then I will publicly attest to having helped him and suffer the same injustice as my guest." The caretaker was well loved by the people, and the priest had no intention of letting something happen to him. So the leaders went away again, and this time searched the scriptures for an answer, for they knew that the caretaker was a man of deep faith. After a whole night of poring over the scriptures, the leaders came back to the caretaker, saying, "We have read the sacred book all through the night seeking guidance, and have found that it tells us that we must respect the authorities of this land and witness to the truth of faith through submission to them." But the caretaker also knew sacred words of scripture and told them that the Bible also asks that we care for those who suffer and are persecuted. So there and then, in desperation, the leaders began to pray fervently. They beseeched God to speak to them, not in a still small voice in their conscience, but rather in the way he had spoken to Abraham and Moses. They begged God to communicate directly to them so that the caretaker would see the error of his ways. Sure enough, the sky began to darken and God descended from heaven, saying, "The priest and the elders speak the truth, my friend. In order to protect this town, the man must be handed over to the authorities." But the caretaker, a man of deep faith, looked up to heaven and replied to God, "If you want me to remain faithful to you, my God, then I can do nothing but refuse your advice. For I do not need the scriptures or your words to tell me what I ought to do. You have already demanded that I look after this man. You have already written that I must protect him at all costs. Your words of love have been spelled out by the lines of this man's face. Your text is found in the texture of his flesh. So, my God, I defy you precisely in order to remain faithful to you. With this, God turned to the town's leaders and addressed them directly. If I cannot convince him, then neither will you. Now leave him in peace. Then God smiled and quietly withdrew, knowing that the matter had finally been settled. Last session, we started with the events of September 11th, trying to recall where we were in those moments and to recall the feelings that we felt, the thoughts that we thought, the conversations that we had, the prayers that we prayed. I want to return there once again at the start of today's session and look at this picture, but take particular note of the fact that this picture taken on September 11th captures a billboard for a brand new television series called 24, which was premiering on Fox later that fall. How many of you have seen 24? Not a big 24 watching audience. All right. We'll say a little bit more about it in a minute. But one of the things that was going on, of course, was that the terrorist threat had been building already. This was in the air. September 11th, in one sense, was shocking in all kinds of ways. And in another sense, it was part of a continuum of acts, including 1993, when the bombing of the World Trade Centers had tried to bring them down. But immediately after September 11th, what we talked about as a nation in terms of heroes were the self-sacrificial public servants who went to the site, especially in New York, but we talked about them in general throughout the regions where events took place in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., and in New York. We talked about heroes in terms of those who sacrificed themselves on that day for the sake of trying to save the innocent. This iconic picture on the rubble of the Twin Towers was captured and probably seen on most front pages of newspapers around the country and was made into a U.S. postal stamp. 24 introduced a different understanding of hero, an understanding of hero that very quickly, as we began the war in Afghanistan and began preparation secretly at first and then publicly for a war in Iraq, held up another sort of hero. And in the series 24, the hero is Jack Bauer, who's played by Kiefer Sutherland. This is a photo advertising the premiere of a new season, premiering Sunday, January 11th. The show goes like this. It's 24 hours. And so the whole season takes place in hour increments. So the first hour of the show will be a literal hour in the 24-hour day. And so the season of the show tries to almost in real time capture the events. And in every scenario for a season, there's some national security threat that within that 24-hour period puts many, many people at risk. And so Jack Bauer works for a counterterrorism unit based in Los Angeles. And his job is to do whatever it takes, whatever is necessary in order to secure the safety of the nation. So that's the basic plot of the story. A background piece from the organization Human Rights First They did some research and they said before September 11th, fewer than 4 scenes of torture appeared on primetime television each year. And the show 24 featured a regular series of torture scenes. In the first 5 seasons, 24 showed 67 scenes of torture. The majority of them performed by Jack Bauer on captives who may have intelligence information to help him save the nation. This article was written in 2008, and the author says in 2007 there were more than 100 primetime incidents of torture. So one of the things that you see in this series is a new understanding of heroism and a new definition of what by all means, by any means necessary, might in fact mean. And so I just want to play the trailer, in other words, the short clip, couple minute clip that advertises season 6, and just give you a flavor for what it's like, and particularly pay attention to how they describe the big story of the season, what will happen. Let's see here.
A special preview of the new season of 24. But first, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank all the fans across the globe for your continued support. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the clip.
Mr. President, the people are losing faith in our ability to protect them.
A threat will rise.
We've proven we can strike it through anytime, anywhere.
Fear will grow.
Today, America is under siege.
Casualty estimate in St. Louis is risen to 112. Baltimore is even worse.
And our only hope lies with one man.
This is from the book Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. And the author is interviewing the lawyer who is at Guantanamo Bay about how they developed the ideas for the harsh interrogation methods that they developed there. Ideas also came from other sources, and Diane Beaver, who is the lawyer at Guantanamo, mentioned one that surprised me. I noted the words 24, Jack Bauer, but didn't immediately follow this up with her. It was only when I got home that I realized she was referring to the main character in the Fox Channel's popular series 24, which everyone watched. And then she says this, Jack Bauer had many friends at Guantanamo Bay, Beaver said. He gave people lots of ideas. The message was clear, torture works. Bauer said, "We saw it on cable. People had already seen the first series. It was hugely popular." Bauer believed that the scenes contributed to an environment in which those at Guantanamo were encouraged to see themselves as being on the front line and to go further than they might otherwise. Nowadays, he says, this lawyer Beaver can't watch 24 anymore. So the interplay between what was happening in our culture, what was happening in media production, and what was happening simultaneously with the military, blur. I picked out this line from Caiaphas in Jesus Christ Superstar: "For the sake of the nation, this Jesus must die." To put in some tension, the portrayal of Jack Bauer as the sacrificial one who must die for the sake of the nation. And I just want you to talk with your neighbor for a few minutes about these questions. What questions does 24 raise for you? Just the little bit that I've unpacked about the show and the role that it played in those years after September 11th especially. And then, who must die for the sake of the nation? What does that language that they use in that trailer say to you in relationship to this period of time in our history? So take a few minutes and just unpack those questions a bit with the person or two next to you. Pull you back from your conversations. Uh, I think there are some particular reasons why in the United States of America, that kind of portrayal of a person like Jack Bauer being, in a sense, a savior for the nation and being viewed as somehow heroic and a savior, despite what he's doing, makes sense. But I want to do a bit of background on a couple of other case studies before we return to the United States and ask some questions about why we as a country might come up with that as a national story. The first case I want to look at briefly is Hitler's Germany. This is the slave labor camp at Buchenwald. It wasn't a death camp, so-called. It was primarily a work camp, although lots and lots of people died there. I picked this picture partly because Elie Wiesel is there on the second row, age 16, and he just accompanied President Obama a couple of weeks ago walking through this very same camp in Germany. What happened in Germany that allowed so much of the church, certainly not all of the church, but so much of the church to support Hitler's rise, and even with some knowledge to support the quote final solution, to support the increasing anti-Semitism. This is a picture of a bunch of different church leaders. I don't have the names, but they represent different traditions, and they tried to bring them together in a quote German church. And I'm particularly interested in what the German Lutherans did. And one real key moment was a confessional statement, a statement written to try and help the German church think about its moment, really. And it was written by a couple of Lutheran theologians, Paul Althaus and Werner Ellert, called the Ansbach Proposal. The town of Ansbach is where they wrote it, as I understand the story. I was a little bit surprised today because of what I think of as a really devastating moment in the history of Lutheranism, the writing of this document, in which they were able to say Adolf Hitler's rise to power was a miracle and a gift of God. That the only reference I could find to it when I Googled it was my own writing. It's just not known. Have people heard of this document? Yeah.
There was actually a film. I think somebody from PLU had something to do with making this documentary.
Right, there's a famous historian of the Holocaust at PLU. Right.
Yeah, we saw that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a history that has to be known and addressed. And it, to my mind, it represents a moment in which lots of complicated things come together, such that a particular understanding of Lutheran theology and the relationship between church and state becomes a broken understanding, a twisted understanding that serves the kind of circumstance that unfolded with the church offering really remarkable support for Hitler. And I put it under the category, the problem of the two kingdoms, and we don't have time, and I'm sure most of us interest in a real detailed theological lecture, but I do want to just sketch what I think the problem was in this circumstance. And if you think about two kingdoms, you have God, and God ruling through the state, and God ruling through the church. And God, in a sense, ordains the pastors to tend this kingdom, the kingdom of Christ and of righteousness and of heaven. So there's a kind of division here, in a sense, of labor on earth. So the church has its authority, and then the state has its own authority, and the rulers of the state are ordained by God to tend to worldly things, political things. And you can imagine certain passages that support this, Romans 13 being a classic text about the church and Christians owing authority to the political leaders who are ordained by God, not only to do good, but also to punish, which was understood in a sense as doing good. And this done as a divide, where the church really gives over a distinct part of human life to the governance ordained by God through the state, is where I want to say the problem lies. That dividing line, the making of it a dualism, allowed them to say, God has ordained the Führer, and so our job is to give thanks to God for God's ordaining of this new leader. You see how that, in a sense, breaks a kind of chunk of life off from the responsibility of Christians, except to pray to God. So, I think that conception that had a particular development long before this in German Lutheranism impacted the nation and played a role in the church's capacity to support what happened. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but it's at least pointing at one way that Christians have gotten it wrong about how church and state go together. A second case I want to look at is Pinochet's Chile. This is a picture of Via Grimaldi, which was a mansion that was turned into a central torture house in Santiago. And if you know the, how many people know the story of Chile in the 70s? How many don't know it? Let's do it that way. So Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile in 72, and he was a socialist. And, I mean, once again, I'm just doing the very simplest story. There's a lot more that could be said, obviously, about this. But the basic story is that his own general, Augusto Pinochet, with the support, clandestine or whatever, of some Western powers, the United States probably, overthrew him in a coup in 1973 or 1972, who knows the date exactly? Was it 72? 73? And in order to consolidate power, one of the things that he started to do was to make of communists and of socialists, a destabilizing force. He, instead of them being the duly elected leaders of the country, he started to create them as a problem, as a destabilizing force, as evil, really. In a similar way, through these different cases, you can see that the enemy in Germany, the Jews were considered rats or vermin. You know that they're turned into animals. And here, in order to consolidate his power, he used that, and they would. You see up here is the sign over this room, Sala de Tortura, Camas Metallicas con Electricidad, and then Parrilla. And the Parrilla is the grill. And what they would do is they would capture former members of the government or people who assisted them, anyone they considered a threat, and they would bring them to this room or to a similar room. And, well, Sheila Cassidy is a British physician who was in Chile at the time. And she, because she was a physician, treated a couple of people who were leaders in the struggle against Pinochet. And so she was captured and brought to Via Grimaldi. And here's what she says about that. Frantically, I said, I'm going to be a nun. This brought a rapid response. You're not one, are you? To which I said, no. Again came the order to undress. I slowly removed my sweater and could not bring myself to go further. Then I felt a rough hand grab my shirt and one of the buttons came off. Realizing they meant what they said and wanting to avoid further mishandling, I removed the remainder of my clothes. The handkerchief around my eyes was by this time a little loose, and I saw that I was in a small room which contained a double metal bunk and a table and a chair. On a wall hung a street plan of Santiago, and crowded into the room, for it was quite small, were about 5 men in plain clothes and a woman. They told me to lie on the bed, and quickly they secured me to the bottom half of the bunk, tying my wrists and ankles and upper arms, and placing a wide band around my chest and abdomen. Then it began. I felt an electric shock pass through me, and then another, and then another. So they used this metal bed without a mattress as a grill, and electricity and a probe to torture people into very often untruthful confessions that served their propaganda purposes. And then they would disappear the people. They would never be found again. Their purpose in doing that largely was to eliminate the possibility that a body would be found. Because a body actually found then is evidence of the torture. So they had a technique that allowed them to, in a sense, take away the body of the protesters and at the same time send terror throughout the whole population, because people knew people were disappearing. They knew this was going on, but there wasn't evidence of it. There wasn't a body, a site where protest could happen, a witness. You know, in Christian history, we talk about martyrs. And martyrs, the word martyr means a witness. And the ingenious, evil thing that they devised was to take away that possibility of having martyrs. So here's Pinochet with John Paul II, who visited in 1987. And was widely criticized for his willingness to go to Chile and to be seen publicly with Pinochet. And when confronted during that period, 1987, with the truth of his leadership of this torturing, he claimed he prayed every day and was a committed Christian, and these were lies invented by the communists. Well, what happened in Chile, what was going on there in terms of church and state? A little different Catholic ecclesiology that ended up keeping the church, and especially the bishops, from a robust acknowledgement, first of all, publicly. They knew privately what was happening, but they didn't acknowledge it publicly. And then from mobilizing in protest about what was happening. I call it the problem of two planes. So here's God, and here's the church, and then here's the state. And the church is sort of hovering between God and heaven. And the church, there's a understanding in Catholic theology of nature and supernature, and grace is what we need to overcome the limitations of our sin. And so there's this orientation upwards in much of Catholic theology, and this understanding that they had of the church as this sort of mystical reality that tended the souls of the country as a whole. So you could say, you know, here's the country, and the church is this mystical body that tends the souls, and the state is the real reality, and it tends the bodies. So it has many of the same effects as the two kingdoms division did, but it's orchestrated differently.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Would you argue that the state was below the church in Chile, or is the state above the church in terms of power?
I would say that they operated hand in glove, that their power worked together. And part of the reason it worked together was because of this invisibility of the church tending the souls and the state being visible and tending the bodies. And so I think they worked together in making each other more powerful than they would have been apart.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
In the 70s, too, you had liberation theology going on.
They
weren't buying that, but they were accused of being Marxists, of course.
Yeah. Well, here's a quote from the Catholic bishops in Chile called The Christian Faith and Political Action in 1973, which certainly would have been influenced by liberation theology, which had already had significant ground speed through the 60s. Gustavo Gutierrez's book, A Theology of Liberation, in 1970, in English and earlier in Spanish. The bishops write that liberation demands the construction of a better world within history, but it is projected also toward a kingdom which is the soul of that history, and at the same time transcends it. So you can hear this language talking about a transcendent reality that's above history and that cares for the soul. This kingdom, including its historical dimension, is not identified with any this-worldly process, economic structure, or political regime. The kingdom hovers above history, entering it only in the soul. Christians enter the temporal world as individuals. The church does not act as a body in the temporal realm. The church doesn't have any political body, but only a religious body, a mystical body, which unites all Christians above the rough and tumble of the temporal. So they started, partly because of liberation theology, leaning towards political understandings, but this understanding of what the church was kept them from conceptualizing the church as a real institution with real concern and responsibility for the body. Yeah?
But the implementation of liberation theology in Central America was different.
Yeah.
And if you look at the disappearing people in Guatemala, the martyrdom of Archbishop Romero, you realize that there are different Catholic churches in different parts of the world.
That's right. Partly it represents the medievalism of the church, the Spanish influence in the church in Chile, and its distinctiveness, and its sense of the church as responsible for the nation as a whole. There's a very strong nationalism that played into this in Chile. Yeah, so the church over the years of Pinochet's reign became very activist and eventually strongly opposed what was happening. But initially they weren't able to mobilize that kind of support or even publicly encourage it because of this, in large part, because they couldn't conceptualize themselves in that way. They had embodied a different sort of church, a mystical church that tended the soul. And what I'm trying to draw out in these case examples is the ways in which how we conceptualize our church life in relationship to the state and how we practice our faith prepares us or doesn't prepare us for crises when they come. And I think in both of these cases, we can see really strong examples of the way in which Christians were generally not prepared to strongly protest when they began to see horrors taking place in their midst. So let's go back now to Bush's USA. This is Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and one of the harsh interrogation tactics, quotes, that they used was to take detainees' phobias and use those phobias as a way to terrify them and make them feel as if they're going to be killed or maimed, as a way to break them and get them to talk. And so that's what you see here. And what I want to suggest for our conversation is that one of the significant problems, it certainly doesn't solve all the questions we might ask, but one of the significant problems in the relationship of the church and the state in the United States is the problem of special providence. I picked out a quote from George Bush's State of the Union address. Many, many things he said, and other presidents have said, could point to this. But he said, this call of history has come to the right country. And while many people viewed his election in 2000 as a fluke based on hanging chads and the ruling of the Supreme Court, he and many of his friends, especially after September 11th, viewed it as an act of God's providence that he became president for a time such as this. And his conviction about the United States' responsibility to spread freedom, his use of the language of the axis of evil, the speech he gave, I think it was the State of the Union in 2002. One of the Bush administration officials came to his speechwriter and said, "What's the one line you can put in this speech that will make the case for us to invade Iraq?" And the speechwriter came up with the language "axis of hatred" for North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. And Michael Gearson, who was working as a speechwriter too and has an evangelical Christian training, went to Wheaton College, changed it to "axis of evil" because it was theologically more like what Bush would say. And so what happens is you have this history all the way back to John Winthrop coming with the Puritans to New England, describing what this new colony would be as a city on a hill. A city that would shine as a beacon of righteousness to the world. And that language becoming embodied in our country's history, in a sense, saying we are the saints. And we can draw the dividing line, not between our own good and bad nature, our own saint and sinner nature, but between us and them. Between we who are righteous and those who are evil. And when that conception becomes a dominant mode within a country, then there's a way in which the church does, in a sense, merge with the state, that America itself as a nation becomes a religious project, and our presidents become religious leaders who in all their speeches acknowledge God. It's so strange to any of you who've had conversations with friends in Europe and Australia and elsewhere, find it just bizarre. And it relates exactly to this history of us finding ourselves as a nation with the special blessing of God upon us. So given that kind of conception of church and state that we have in the United States, it helps make some sense of why we might imagine Jack Bauer as this savior figure. His sacrifice of his, first of all, his morality. The writer of that show, 24, says Jack Bauer is damned. But he's saved because of his sacrifice saving the nation. Let's take just a minute before we turn to a concluding response, a spiritual practice that helps us respond, and just see where people are, if people have comments. One of the challenges of opening up these questions is our discussion time never could encompass everything we ought to talk about. But let's take a minute, a couple of minutes, and just see what responses people have to where we are right now. Yeah.
Well, here's my difficulty in some sense. You talked about Chile and Allende having been elected. Well, Hitler was elected.
Right.
Granted, he got a plurality. But he was elected legitimately at first. What would we have been justified in doing to stop him? Maybe we weren't justified in doing whatever we did do vis-a-vis Chile and Allende. Set that aside for a moment.
What would we in the United States have been justified in doing in relation?
The church in Germany. But in part, that's another difference here, is that our government's action has been not totally, but largely outward directed, whereas in the other two cases, obviously Hitler did a lot outside Germany as well, but a lot of what you were focusing on was directed against his own citizens, granted a minority of them, but
yeah, the
if we're dealing with bad actors in the world on that level, what are we justified in doing to stop them?
Part of my question is, how do we understand ourselves as a church so that we have a corporate voice that's not at one with the state, but acts as a counter voice, an independent voice, a voice that has, in a sense, allegiance elsewhere and above the allegiance that it owes to the state? And if the church has that kind of voice, then it's able to speak the truth that it sees much more quickly and strongly. And when that doesn't happen, like last session I showed a survey of Christian responses to the question, when faced with a national security threat, is torture in order to get information justified? And many of the people, 65, 70% of the respondents said that their judgment came from their personal experience, from their gut, not from reflecting on the values of their Christian faith. So I partly interpret that as the fact that in the United States we think of our national life in religious terms, and think of our national life as having the special providence, and so people very often have especially if they're it's true of my dad. I mean, I just think it's very common that people have a very strong, almost religiously tinged patriotism in the United States. And it predisposes them very often to respond not on the basis of what the Bible might say, but their conception of the United States and the allegiance they owe to it. So I'm just asking the question, how do we make space for an independent, in a sense, critical voice of the church? And I think we didn't have a very strong critical voice in the United States of what Hitler was doing initially. It took quite a while. We turned back refugees. Oh, yeah, back here.
So, Chris, I'm wondering what would have happened if they'd asked the people of the United States whether we believe that we have a right, thanks to our special providence, to dominate the world. And what do you think we would have said?
Well, one of the truisms about survey questions is it all depends on how it's worded.
Yeah, okay.
But I think you could ask a question like that in a, you know, taking care with the language so you didn't make yourself out to be a liberal trying to dupe people. And you would get very significant positive response. I think you would.
And what would the people in Rome have said?
Yeah, well, at least the ones who had got the benefits of it probably would have said the same. Yeah, Jack.
I think sacrificial language is dangerous.
Yeah, say more.
Well, what happens, and sociologists have studied this, is that scapegoating mechanism, of this person's going to take the sins of the country away from us, or this group of people is going to take our stress away. This is the way culture has been formed over time. And religion uses the language of scapegoating.
Yeah. That's the framework they're using for Jack Bauer. You can see it.
Yeah. And I would simply think that the church has thought through scapegoating. At least the Christian claim, and some voices say, that God is not a God of sacrifice. That Jesus' death was the death of God. It was an awful, ungodly thing. And that God is only a God of life. And so to think through the way religions are formed, the way our communities are formed, and to think not in terms of sacrifice,
yeah,
but in terms of self-giving love.
We're going to exactly raise those issues about how we understand the salvific impact of Jesus' death in relationship to how we practice communion, how we practice the Eucharist tomorrow. And try and make the case that just like our understanding of the church impacts how we're empowered to engage society and the state particularly, how we understand and practice communion also has a real significant impact on who we are as a people and what we understand our call to be. And there's certainly understandings of communion and of Jesus' salvation which are deeply sacrificial, not in the way that you're arguing, but contrary to it.
Well, and I'd also add that out of a Christian faith self-understanding, it can critique itself and the state.
Yeah.
And that voice of criticism can be heard. It could be heard in Germany with Bonhoeffer and the Confessing Church.
Yeah.
And that one moment when Lutheranism was duped, in a sense, can be repented of and changed. And,
yeah,
and same with the Roman Catholic Church in Chile. Could liberation theology could say a critical word that offers an alternative to the state.
Yeah.
We think differently.
I think that's good. One more comment here, and then let me lead us into our closing spiritual practice.
Just to add to Jack's comment, I think the church could do a heck of a lot, or maybe this is just a crazy idea I have, but if the church can really be a spokesperson for the world. I mean, in Chile, for example, most people in the United States supported Pinochet.
Right.
The government supported Pinochet. They
right.
funded the entire coup.
Right.
Everybody thought Allende was doing, I mean, he was, there were definitely problems in what he was trying to do in his socialist government. It was too much, too fast, and it didn't work out. But people were really quick to support Pinochet. And they, how many people in the United States, I wonder, knew about the desaparecidos,
yeah,
knew about the people who were getting thrown into the ocean.
Yeah.
And is the church seeing the whole story? And I don't, and what, where are we getting our news? You know, for a long time there, Fox News really controlled a lot of people's minds, or the news media or internet. And is the church telling the people what's happening? Is
yeah.
the church the informants of what's going on in the world?
Yeah.
And I just wonder what would happen if the church did do that.
Yeah.
You
could give lots more examples of what happened in Chile during that same era in other countries.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the American church speaks with one voice, though, because that
no.
picture keeps reminding me that Mark Hansen and others from the
that's right.
tried to go and talk to Bush about Iraq, and
he wouldn't meet with them. That's right.
So there were attempts.
That's right.
State can choose to not ignore.
That's right.
Not listen.
I want to close with raising the question about how we pray, and each time I'm closing with a spiritual practice because I truly believe that the things that we do are connected to our understanding. Thinking isn't just from the neck up, it's a full-bodied experience. And one of the most powerful ways that America has prayed over the last decade has been out of the prayer of Jabez, which is a sort of classic prosperity, God is blessing us kind of prayer. And I would laugh at it, literally I would laugh at it if it weren't for this bottom fact, which is that it topped number one on the New York Times bestselling list and is over 9 million copies sold. And when it's all over the internet and stuff, you can bet a lot of people are aware of it who haven't bought the book. So its cultural impact is huge. So this, if this is our practice of prayer, what I want to suggest is this might just reinforce the sense of our own special providence, that God is blessing us, and we're saintly because we know to ask God for what we want. And I want to close by showing you an alternative proposal about prayer and asking you on your sheets of paper to respond to the to the prayer suggestion on the next slide with your own prayer. And then you can either take it with you and carry it in your pocket, or you can leave it here in the center on the cross. As you're ready, you can just write out what you want to, a prayer of your own, or comment or sentence on your paper, and take it with you as you leave quietly, or you can come by the center and leave it on the cross.